Bum bum bottom, 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 bum bum bottom,
You are now in session with the Comic Book Couples Counseling Podcast. I'm Lisa Gullickson.
And I'm Brad Gullickson.
And each month we evaluate a different iconic romance within the four-color realm. And in this episode, the unease crept in gradually. It almost went unnoticed. A soft disquiet just beneath the surface. Or perhaps it was always there, inside me, waiting for me to wake up in our creator corner. Becky Cloonan and Tula Lote lift the veil between sleeping and waking to talk Somna from Distillery Comics.
I said it before and I'll say it again. These intros are getting even more elaborate and longer, Lisa.
Why, thank you. I feel like I've cracked the code to writing these intros super fast.
Well, congratulations on that. And happy new comic book day.
Yay! It's a Wednesday.
I really feel like comic book readers have it so sweet with our Wednesdays. You know, every week we have a little holiday to get us through the rest of the week.
I'm a strong believer in treats. Like, as an adult, I am still very, like, if I were a dog, they would say, ooh, this one is food motivated. You know what I mean? Like, I need a treat. And for me, Wednesdays are my treat where I go like, you know what? I've lived a whole half a week.
Yeah.
I deserve a little pat on the back in the form of new issues.
I think our primary love language, both of us, is words of affirmation.
Yes.
Please keep those iTunes reviews coming.
Yes.
But I also agree that receiving gifts is important too.
But receiving gifts from yourself. Like, if you're going to receive gifts, like, what a low burden gift. Is it like a gift from me to me? I know I like it.
Yeah. And so we do that every Wednesday and it never fails. I walk into Big Planet Comics. I talk to Nicole or Jared or Kevin and, you know, they give you our pull box and we know there's gold in that pull box already, but then come the surprises. Every week there is an issue that you're going to try and go like, all right, let's this sounds interesting. Or Nicole will be like, no, you got to read this.
Yeah.
And Somna was one of those comics where Nicole was like, no, you need to read Somna, Brad, and Lisa. You're going to enjoy this.
But it didn't take that much encouragement because it's Becky Cloonan and Tula Lote. Like, it's going to be amazing.
Yeah, and also this new distillery format, these magazine treasury-sized issues, like, that's catnip for Brad and Lisa.
Oh, man, so yummy. I just like to, you know, you guys know, I love to lay on my belly with a comic. This one is, it's spread wide open for me.
Okay, Lisa, now I think that might be a little too intimate for our readers.
I feel like we have to set the tone.
This is a clean show, as we've told Apple Podcasts.
We clicked one thing one time.
And we're clean forever. So, you know, let's leave how you interact with Somna right there. And no one wants to know how I interact with it.
Yikes. You did tell me, like, don't read this one at a coffee shop.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, or if you're going to read it at a coffee shop, like, you know, just be aware of your neighbors.
Use your discretion.
But this comic is super sexy, right?
Yes.
It is pretty darn spooky. And it's also very playful. You know, having Becky Cloonan and Tula Lote bounce back and forth throughout the issues as reality and dream intermix.
Mm-hmm. Like, we often talk about creators collaborating on a comic as like this romance. And for Becky Cloonan and Tula Lote, this was like a slow burn where they admired each other's works from afar. They start dabbling with the idea of, oh, what's something that we can do together? And then they stayed in that place for a full decade.
Yeah.
So what we have in Somna is this extremely, like, mature idea. They have lived in this idea, and they create this world that is so evocative.
And the conversation we're about to have begins with the origins, the inspirations of Somna, but then quickly goes into how it became what it is, which still holds hints of that inspiration, but is something totally different apart from that inspiration. They've spoken in previous interviews that this comic grew out of their love for a couple of B-movies, one being The Entity with Barbara Hershey and the other one being Witchfinder General starring Vincent Price. And both of those films are fantastic as grimy B-movies, but they're also grimy B-movies. And while Somna has some grime in it, it doesn't have the male-gazy grime of those films.
I would in fact say that it has a female gaze to it, which as a female reader is extremely compelling. I feel like when we talk about female gaze, we go like, there's no objectification to it. And as a female, allow me to say, that is not the truth. We're objectifying all of the time. We just have the restraint to not be gross about it.
Okay.
Okay, I'm gonna do the plot now. Here it is. Somna takes place in the 1600s during the time of witch trials. And Ingrid is married to Roland, who is the witch finder of her town. But she is also having these weird sexual dreams about this shadowy figure. And throughout the story, the shadowy figure is seducing her. And she feels like she can't tell anyone, because if she tells someone, they're going to go like, clearly that is a demon and you are a witch. Get on this stake. You know?
Yeah. And it's exciting to read this comic because there is a tension between whether or not this shadow man, this demon, is real. And I feel like the comic has that answer early on, but I found myself resisting that answer because I so often come to witch stories through the lens of the Crucible and Witchfinder General, right? And history too, because we have witnessed how men want to maintain their power and control women's bodies using paranoia and religious doctrine to do it. So it's easy to hate characters like Roland in this story and the village priest, but if the demon is real, and that means the priest and Roland are also right about the presence of demonic evil, what does that mean?
Mm.
What is being said with Somna? And that's what's so compelling about it. And also this conversation with Becky Cloonan and Tula Lote.
Just so you know, this is going to be a full spoilers conversation. And hey, it's Wednesday. The third issue came out today. So if you haven't read any of Somna, no shame in your game, but you're going to want to catch up. So get all three issues and read them right now.
And if you haven't yet, pick up some of the other Distillery books. There's a lot going on over at that company right now. We definitely recommend Gone from Jock. And we were lucky enough to read the first issue of Spectrograph, the new book from James Tynan IV and Christian Ward. And you can bet we will be talking more about that one on Comic Book Couples Counseling in the very near future. Now, before we get to our conversation with Becky and Tula Lisa, we need to do some
referrals.
Sponsored by Omnibus. Omnibus is a modern digital comic book store and reader app carrying your favorite single issues, volumes, and omnibuses all day and date. Just like your local comic book store, you pay per book, but digital.
Their focus is on building an excellent customer shopping and reading experience and using novel discovery features to help fans find their next new favorite book. They feature top-tier content and already have many of the top publishers in comics today.
In the spirit of helping people find their next new favorite book, we have our referrals segment. The idea is to give our counselees, that's you guys, further reading on the themes of the episode. Think of it as us sending you to specialists to further your healing journey through comic books. So Lisa, for my referral, I wanted to stick on the theme of witches, but I wanted to go to a totally different tone. something a little bit more contemporary, something that's a little bit westerny, but not full westerny, just a dash of westerny.
I'm on board.
I'm talking about Witchblood from artist Lisa Stirl and writer Matthew Ehrman. The main character is Yana, and she's traveling the Southwest with her coven, but they are being pursued by a vampire biker gang called the Hounds of Love, because they don't covet just any old kind of neck. They seek the tastiest of necks. And in this world, witch blood has magical properties for vampires. And that's why they are hunting down Yana. The comic definitely doesn't have as much nudity as Somna, but it's still pretty darn sexy. And I feel like this fulfills a need for people who grew up watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So I'm thinking specifically of you, Lisa.
Oh, that's
I think you
very
would
sweet.
Really enjoy Witchblood from Lisa Stirl and Matthew Ehrman. It's published from Vault and currently available on Omnibus.
For my referral, I wanted to go with something on the theme of when you have to consider other people's view of your sexuality, it really complicates your own view of your sexuality. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the book that I chose was Adversary by Blue Delaquanti. This is definitely rated M for mature, like Somna. There's a ton of nudity and sexy stuff happening that you don't necessarily want someone to see over your shoulder at a coffee shop for their comfort. But what it's about is these two men run into each other, and it turns out that they knew each other from almost like a previous life.
Okay.
So one of the men is a personal trainer that focuses on like women's self-defense classes. And the other person is a trans man who used to take the class. And after running into each other, they decide to start a sexual relationship where they are reenacting some of the self-defense moves that they did in the class. And both of them, I feel like, are not necessarily emotionally in a place to have that kind of relationship. And so it gets very complicated immediately. The personal trainer guy has recently come out of the closet. He's still married to his previous wife and trying to keep a friendship relationship, just like a different kind of partnership with her. But he associates sex with intimacy, like with like a personal type of intimacy. We're having sex. I should know your first and last name. I should know your personal history. You know, we should be friends. And the other person is saying like, I just want to have this sex thing with you, and I don't want to share those things with
looking
you.
Looking for a casual experience.
Yeah, and like there's one scene in particular that really reminded me of Somna and how Ingrid ended up feeling so isolated because she discovers, oh, I have no one I can talk to about this. And it's when the personal trainer guy tries to call his wife, going like, well, she said we were going to be friends still, but she also kind of told me that she doesn't want to talk about my sexual escapades.
Okay.
So he calls her for some comfort and realizes quickly, oh, there is no comfort to be had there, at least right now.
Interesting. Okay, cool. And this comes from Silver Sprocket.
Yes.
And, you know, we're marks for Silver Sprocket as well.
It's a beautifully drawn book, too. Like, the artistry level is absolutely stunning. There's a really vulnerable letter in the back from the author talking about, this is a fictional story, but there are personal elements to the story that I help contextualize it a lot. It gives you a lot to think about.
All right, I will seek this out. Look, we're referring comics to each other this week. That's nice.
Yeah, and both of these books available on Omnibus, y'all.
And Omnibus right now is available as an app for your iPhone. So before we would say like, hey, if you have a browser, you have access to a shop, and that is all still true, but now you can download the app and put it on your iPhone, and the Android version is in progress, and a beta will be happening real darn soon.
You can also do wish lists now, which I think is so important because I cannot stress this enough. This is not a subscription service. This is a store, you are going to buy the books. A beautiful thing about shopping that I love is putting things in my cart and walking around a little
right,
bit.
So
your wish list, it's a to-read pile where you are not financially invested.
It's like a
nice whimsical pocket, a nice little whimsical cart where you can put books you want to read.
I'm enjoying the omnibus wish list immensely right now. I've been collecting our referrals into a wish list.
Ooh.
So, yeah.
I've just been buying our referrals. So.
Yeah, me too. Lisa, that's going to bring us to the end of our...
referrals.
So a couple notes about this conversation you're about to hear. One, Tulalote is a little late. She comes into the conversation halfway through. There was some confusion there, you know, time zones being weird and all that. But she does show up and she does contribute a lot to the conversation. But initially, it's just Lisa and Brad talking to Becky Cloonan. And the other thing is that you may or may not be aware, but Tulalote, that's her pseudonym. She's actually Lisa, and when Becky Cloonan is referring to Lisa, she's not talking about our Lisa, she's talking about her Lisa.
I'm just so excited for you all to hear this conversation, because we are such big fans of Becky Cloonan and Tulalote, both separately and together. Having them both on one episode is like, what a dream, what a treat. I'm very treat motivated, we've talked about it.
Becky, welcome to Comic Book Couples Counseling, hello.
Hello, I'm so happy to be here.
We are excited to talk to you, especially about Somna and especially about Witchfinder General, which we know was one of the inspirations behind this comic, paired with the Entity. And Lisa and I were talking about Witchfinder General before you came into our Zoom room. And, you know, we were talking about witch trials and witch trial movies and stories. And there are so many places you could be inspired from. You could be inspired by The Crucible, for example, but Witchfinder General is so specific. What is it about that film that found its way into the DNA of Somna?
Ooh, I think it's one of those movies where you just see it at a young age and it's like, you know, it just makes a, like an impression and you just can't let go of it. So when Lisa and I were talking about Somna, of course, this was one of the movies that came up as far as like time period and feeling. Like, we both love Hammer horror films. Like, so that was a big inspiration for us, like going in. Like, you know, we had been talking about Somna for about 10 years. So we had plenty of time to develop like the look and the feel of it. And, you know, I mean, The Crucible is great, but there's something about Witchfinder General. I mean, it's over the top. It's a little camp, but it's scary too. So
there's something that is very organic about Witchfinder General and those Roger Corman movies of that era that I think plays really well with what the two of you are doing in Somna.
Yeah. Some of it is probably Vincent Price's performance as Matthew Hopkins. And I mean, they're both, when you look at Witchfinder General and you said The Crucible before, they're both historical, you know, these are based on actual events. Witchfinder General, I don't know. It's historical, but it's also living in the realm of fantasy.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we wanted to land with Somna. Like, it's historical, but it's also like, you know, we're not telling a historical story. It's very much a fantasy.
It's also my understanding that you were also inspired by your having sleep paralysis. I'm pretty sure I've had sleep paralysis, so I would love to hear like what your experience was like and how it inspired the story.
You've probably had it. Everyone's probably had it to some degree. It's like a weird sleep thing where, and if you haven't had it, you're basically awake, but your brain is still giving off a chemical to say to your body that you're asleep. So you're awake, you're lucid, but you can't move and you might see things. Mm-hmm. And so that was where I was living in New York. I was in like this apartment building and it was a little older, and there had been one of the tenants below me passed away and they didn't find him for a bit, but I could smell it. And it was a creepy experience, just knowing that someone was like dead beneath you, like on the floor right below you for like a week or two. And then I started having sleep paralysis and I was seeing this like shadowy figure, like standing in the door, like right out of the corner of my eye, but I couldn't look directly at it, but I knew it was there. And then I would see it like around the room and I was like, it's this dude. He's coming to haunt me. Like, I was like, you know, in your brain, that's the first thing that you think. But the more that I read about it, the more I was like, oh, it's your brain puts that there because you're scared. And it's like, hey, you should be scared of something right now. I'm going to put this here. Thanks, brain. That's great. But
yeah,
people will see similar things, I think. Some people see like aliens. Some people see like an old woman. It's just like things that inherently people are like kind of spooked by, you know?
For me, like my sleep paralysis experience was much more like the third issue of Somna. I know that I'm awake, but I can't move. Oh no, I'm dreaming. I know that I'm awake, but I can't move. So it's like that skipping rocks thing that really makes you like hyper aware of like the veil between like dreaming and waking.
Yeah.
And it gets me like thinking about like, it can both be true that the demon is real and the demon was just a dream.
Yeah.
Was it important for you to put something that brought the existence of the demon in question in the story, where you're going like, this person is just having sleep paralysis and now they're being burned at the stake? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was, well, it's definitely like, so it started out as, hey, this is a fun kernel for a story, you know, and thankfully I'm not plagued by sleep paralysis. Like I had it like a handful of times during a certain period and then it just stopped. Mm-hmm. But the memory of it stuck with me. And then it's like, of course, you know, what if it was sexy though? It's not sexy at all, but what if it was though?
Yeah.
Like, and that's kind of where the story, it started out as like a silly thought, you know, as a lot of stories do. And then when I was talking to Lisa about it, we just would, every time we would see each other, we'd like speak more and more about this idea. And it's like, well, what if we put her in a time when demons were very much like a real thing and witches were very much real. And it, these were things you actually had to like watch out for, and they were walking among us. And then what if you had that experience and were convinced like this could be something that is actually real? Like what if it was, you know, a tangible person in the room with, what if the person was in the room with me, the sleep paralysis demon? Yeah. And it just kind of spiraled out from there. And then it was just doing like a lot of research and reading. And yeah, I did a stupid amount of research for a book that is not historical.
Well, like that's the exciting thing about Somna, though, is when you look at this period in time where paranoia was running wild and we were murdering women.
Not at all relatable, right? So glad that time's over.
and the excuse being, well, you know, they've been touched by the devil. And then now here you are with a story that is still exploring the paranoia of that and the atrocity of that. But there is also a shadow man. And that like really put me on edge during the entire experience, where it's like, well, okay, these people are being terrible, but there is a shadow man. And is this shadow man the devil?
Yeah. And some of that is, you know, how much of this is in your own mind? You know, how much is the things that society tells you to believe are actually real, and how much of it is just like something that you manifest yourself and you make it real? I mean, I love a self-fulfilling prophecy. And when you go back and you read stuff like, talk about Witchfinder General, Matthew Hopkins, a real person, wrote a book, The Discovery of Witches. It's so bad. Like, you try reading it, this thing is unreadable. But I read it for science, you know. and there is parts of the book that are taken directly from this text. So it's like there's a sermon in the book in issue two that was taken from a sermon, like not word for word because it was long and rambling, but you know, I did take lines from it and stick it in there. And there's marriage vows in issue three. Those were actual marriage vows. Like none, like this is real stuff that like people believed. And if you're surrounded by it, and if you believe in it with all of your heart, like you're supposed to. And then if you don't believe in it, what does that say about yourself? You know, like you're damned either way, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't. And, you know, God, I love that too. That's basically where all this is, you know, marinating. And
what struck me was how lonely Ingrid was in her suffering. Like she couldn't really talk to Roland about it. And she loved Roland. She found out her friend wasn't trustworthy. She couldn't talk to her about it. She couldn't confess to the priest. And how just tremendously isolating the idea of having sexuality at all was at that time.
Yeah, yeah, it was bad. And, you know, women at the time, there was a courtroom scene in issue three, and like the men and women are kind of sitting mixed together. But in reality, they would have been sitting on opposite sides of the room. It was very segregated. And women, you know, there was times when women would be able to get together. There was a point in time when that was like outlawed, where women couldn't even gather without a man present. So you really historically lost all of that sense of community. It was, I imagine it would be very isolating, especially when you're talking about something that could get you potentially, you know, killed and, you know, or put in jail for, you know, having this other experience. You know, being another wasn't a good thing. Mm-hmm. In any way, you know.
We were discussing the shadowy figure and how they're not really that nefarious, you know, like if, so like going back to the other question of like, well, if this thing is real, then there is a demonic presence, but
is the demonic presence something that is actually doing anything bad?
Right.
Like I go like, oh, I think the demon is like chaotic neutral. Because he's not asking her to do anything that is inherently bad, unless his plan is, you know, okay, I'm going to get this person killed and implicate all of these other people. Okay, now I have, you know, just started the toilet flush of sin, and now I'm getting all of these people for the price of one good fucking.
But for that to work, you have to bring in your own story.
Right.
Yeah. And then there's also like the, does he just want one soul? Like what's his, what's this, if he is a demon, what's their motivation? And the great thing is like, I don't even know if there's an answer to that. You know, if it's like, is there actually a demon? I don't know. Like we wrote it so ambiguously, and we wrote it in such a way where it could be, you know, you could find proof either way that this thing is real or not. And that's kind of the fun of the story. In, I think in my headcanon, and I have headcanon about my own story, mm-hmm. I think that it is real. I'd like to think it's real. And, you know, maybe it's not a happily ever after for Ingrid, but, you know, at least maybe she has a little fun along the way.
If it is real, like, then where's God? Right?
Exactly.
If you think they're demons, like, where is God? Is the answer just exactly?
Exactly. Where is he?
Where is he?
Definitely not present in this story. And I think you can see, I think if there is a God in this story, it's shown through the actions of like the priest, which are, it's not great, you know. I think his, everything that's representative of the good is actually not good. And the evil is, I mean, it is evil, but it's also not good. Nothing's good in this story, really.
Yeah.
Except Ingrid. Ingrid's so sweet.
Ingrid is good. And I suspect, I feel in my head canon, Becky Clunan, I feel like Roland is actually good, but
Roland
just
good.
Terribly mistaken, you know? I feel so bad for him. Like, you guys ended Roland's story with, okay, and now he's plagued by doubt, you know? Am I actually doing the right thing, you know?
Yeah.
I think he had every intention of loving Ingrid.
Definitely. And I think this was, you know, when you go into it, the Witchfinder is always like so gleeful and like, persecute the women. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure that Roland wasn't in it for this. This wasn't fun for him, and to make it known that he's not happy about this work that he's doing, and that he's doing it out of a sense of duty because he thinks it's right. He's like, we got to get these witches out of here. You know, he's, the ruin of all witches is what his goal is, but he's not, you know, happy about it. And then when it's Ingrid, of course, he's even less happy about it. Going so far as to be like, if you are a witch, use your powers and get out of here. Like, I don't want you to die, mm-hmm. which is like, you know, that's not good for him to do. But you know, I don't want to say he had like a hero turn, because that's not it. But I did want to show that in this community, it's not just good and evil. There's people who think that they're doing good, but they're not, you know. It's like, you just put your faith in the wrong institution, man. And you're for the rest of your life, you're going to be fucked up for it. You know,
I love the choice to create empathy for people doing bad things, because I do feel like we live in a time of like intense distrust and paranoia. And we see things that happen and we go, this person could not possibly actually think this, you know?
Yeah.
Did you find yourself like drawing these parallels to our dystopian present?
A little bit. I do believe that people are shades of gray, that there's no, you know, black and white. So when it came to Roland's story in particular, it was important for me to be like, what is his angle? You know, mm-hmm. I didn't want everyone just to be like one note bad or one note good, where, you know, he's got to have a redeeming quality, like at least one. Just like, you know, the worst person, you know, just made a great point. That's kind of Roland.
Mm-hmm. But then we have Maya, who like,
oh yeah,
started as this trusted person, but is probably up there with Father Goodman as like one of the most evil people in this story. Like, what was the choice to make another woman a villain?
I think it just was like the idea that there's someone that you can trust, that you really care about, that you think you're on board with, and then just do a total heel turn, which is always fun to do.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it was showing like, okay, here's, you know, someone who's obviously not following the rules of society. She's outside. She's like doing her own thing, just like Ingrid is, you know, but mm-hmm. she's reveling in it, and she's, you know, narcissistic probably, and like a little bit of a sociopath. And these things can also exist, you know, so you have Father Goodman on one side who's like, I'm upholding the law, ha ha ha, and he's nefariously cackling in the background. And then Maya as well. And, you know, by the third book, it's insinuated that if there is a witch, she's probably actually the witch, you know, that they're looking mm-hmm. for, but they can't find it because she's like, you know, kind of playing everybody. And she's, you know, of course, I don't think it was this book. So it's 6 issues long, basically. It's 3 issues, but each issue is twice the size. So in my head, when we were breaking it down, it was like, okay, it's basically the length of a 6-issue story. I would have loved to put more characters in, but it was kind of like, you only have a certain page count. And it's like, we got it, even from the breakdown that we did, I think I had another character. Roland was actually 2 characters in the beginning. Mm. There was like the Witchfinder bailiff kind of character. And then there was Roland, who was the husband. And I was like, we don't have room for these 2 characters. It was just pushing down into one. And that's the same with Maya, where it's like, she could be 2 or 3 characters. But with the time, it was just like, the economy of story, we need to make her just 1 character. So she does contain multitudes, and I quite like her. And it was, sometimes it's fun just to write someone who's unabashedly just bad, you know, that person that you knew your whole life. And then one day you wake up and you're like, do I even know this person? Like, who are they this whole time? Have they been like, I think we've all had an experience like that.
Yeah. I think it's also important to show how, you know, the culture that they are living in is infecting everybody, and in an extreme negative fashion.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, you know, there's no camaraderie. People are very secretive, and, you know, as much as Ingrid wants to trust Maya, I think there's that, you know, even in the beginning, she's like, I can't tell anyone about this. You know, if there was one person she could tell, it would be her friend. But then you find out very quickly, your friend is not the person that you thought. So she's like, you going back to what you said, she's just very isolated.
One of the other joys of the comic is the artistic experience of watching you and Tula rotate, you know, dream and reality. But then as the series progresses, the two styles merge, and what is dream, what is reality? Can you talk a little bit about breaking that down in your process?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, Lisa and I, like I was saying, we've been talking about this for so long. And now that it's over, I'm like, what do I do with myself? That's so strange. We had always wanted to do a story like complete, like just a collaboration at like the most in its purest form, where there was no distinction between like who's writing what and who's drawing what. It made sense for her to do the dream sequences because her art is so ethereal and so sublime. And, you know, there's a hazy quality to it where you're just, you know, there's the panels are more freeform, you know, and my stuff, even though it's not as realistic as hers, it made sense for it to be the reality because it was so, it's black and white, it's a little more stark, it, you know, things are more defined and easy to see. And then so when we broke up each issue, it was like we have to have the same amount of pages in each issue.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of tricky to be like, you know, when we would do the outline, we have like the whole thing kind of written out, and then it was like, and Lisa's dream sequences is here and here and here. And so she knew what I was doing in real life. And then we would talk about what was happening in each dream sequence to kind of reflect that. And she would go in and do that. And then after everything was finished, we would put it all together in like a big PDF or whatever and be like, does this flow well? Like a lot of places we added extra pages or like tweaked panels around. And Lisa was in charge of doing all visual transitions. So like anywhere there's like her like work kind of bleeding into mine and like washes over my art, that's her kind of going over it and like smoothing out transitions and like bringing themes, like visual themes through the story, like the fire and the water that kind of reappears. That's her. And then I was in charge of script. So I would do the words on it. And then she would go over and be like, okay, let's, you know, refine it or like, can you add a line here? Stuff like that. So, and of course, Will Dennis, our editor, kind of kept us both on track with that. And Lee Luffridge colored my pages. And he did just an incredible job. And I worked with him so much on other things. So it was cool to see, like, it really was just this big collaboration. And we didn't know how it was going to work, really. We did like the short thing for the Devil's Cut story as like a proof of concept. And that kind of got us like seeing how we work, like, because we'd never worked together before. Even though we're both so familiar with each other's art, that was kind of like a good like place to start. And then I feel like we didn't actually get to like the, like, to really figure it out into like book three, of course.
Yeah.
Here comes Lisa.
She's tagging in.
This is a double Lisa episode. Can the universe handle twice the Lisa?
I'm here.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello. Thank you. I'm so sorry for being late.
Not a problem. We've been sharing our own headcanons of what we think the comic is. We've just completed reading the third issue, and we're trying to figure out like how we feel about the shadow figure and the reality of the shadow figure. And for Becky, she mentioned that her headcanon is it's a real entity. This is a fantasy story. Are you aligned with Becky in that regard?
Yeah, 100%. But, you know, the thing that Becky and I enjoy doing, and especially in the stories that we read and the films that we watch, it's always that ambiguity in storytelling where the viewer can make up their own mind. And so we've tried to do that with Somna. We definitely have ideas about what we think is happening. But there is a lot open to interpretation. And also, I don't want to give anything away right at the end, but the very end, I think we probably both feel something different about, because it is open to interpretation and it could go either way.
We've already spoiled the ending.
The conversation is going to come out after the comic is out. And so the conceit of the episode is that we're unloading all our thoughts about the entire series. And so I would like to explore that a little bit, how you differ.
Yeah. Are you okay with me talking about that, Becky?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. The last scene was like one of the first things that we thought of with this comic. Yeah. So it was like, that was our starting point.
Okay.
Yeah. And actually, Becky and I don't think we've talked about this since the book actually was finished. But one of the first things we talked about was Becky mentioning the story and then saying all these things happen. And we were thinking, where would it be set and stuff? And Becky said, I just know I want the ending to be the shadow man choking her and then saying, can you breathe? And him saying no. Her saying no and him saying good, and it sent shivers down my spine. I was like, oh my God, that's just horrific. Let's do it. But the way I've drawn it is that very last panel where he says, open your eyes, it cuts to blue. So it's like he's taken her somewhere else and maybe he is her savior after all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When you like had that like blue panel at the bottom, it did change. Like, cause when we started this, it was like, this is a horror story. It's got to end poorly. You know, we need to make it upsetting. And so that was kind of like going in, it's like she's going to die, she gets burned at the stake, but the Shadow Man's kind of there and he's the one doing it, so it's not quite as bad, you know, like saves her from the flames by choking her. That's great, you know. But then when Lisa turned her like blue at the end, so she matched like the Shadow Man's colors, it was like, oh, he's like actually like opened her eyes to, you know, this new, he's done what he's promised basically. And like, I don't know if he's whisked her away somewhere else, but she's in a different place. So visually, yeah. It did, like, I was like, this is the cool way to do it. So there's so many levels of ambiguity. Like, was it smoke inhalation? You know, in the end, it was like, historically, they didn't even burn witches in England. They hung them. And then it was Scotland where they burned witches and Europe. But in Scotland, they wouldn't burn them alive. They would choke them first. They were dead. Mm-hmm. And then burn them. So it was like more symbolic. But so, yeah, our comic, not historical. But basically just like, how do we just make this so upsetting?
Yeah. And when when we were drawing that end scene, that very last panel where she's looking up with her eyes up and like she's fully aware of everything that's happening, it's horrible, that I originally did color that in flames. So it was just going to be a close-up of her face dying, which is horrible. And then I switched the color last minute thinking, this is suggesting that she has gone somewhere else. And I wanted to talk to you about that beforehand, before we did the final script, Becky. And then, but you just like read it and you just went with it. And now
I was, oh yeah, like, I knew it.
And we're so in tune. I think we're just like, really, we've been so engrossed in this story and telling it that it's like we're in one another's brain.
Yeah. When you sent that, because I saw both edits, I saw just the fire. And then when you sent over the final, that's when I went in and added the extra line where it was like, oh yeah, you can open your eyes now, like it's safe kind of thing. There's so many different ways to read that ending. And I think anyone is valid. I don't think there's like an invalid way, you know, if this was all in her head, maybe she just went out with one last hallucination, and that's kind of nice, I guess.
Yeah.
Or if this was actually like, if the Shadow Man was real and did save her, you know.
Yeah. But also, you know, we're kind of looking at a story that deals with demons and hell and all the things that we think are absolutely terrifying, but actually what's happening in the real world under the religion of Christianity for women was the most horrific thing ever. So why wouldn't the opposite be better? Why wouldn't that be the salvation? There's just so many questions around this story and the time, and that's what I love about it.
One of my favorite hooks for this story is paralleling orgasmic noises to struggling and death noises, and how that came up multiple times of like, you're making crazy noises, and if anybody is standing outside and hearing it, like that would be like bad. And then also she is wondering about the noises of the woman on the stake and all of that stuff, thinking about Elizabethan era, like, you know, to come is to die, you know, like that is like the spine of the story for me.
In the very beginning, when she's having her first dream and Roland wakes her up in issue 1, and he's like, you were making these noises. We never know. I think it's assumed because she was having a sexy dream that she was making, you know, a certain kind of noise. But when you, in my head, it was always kind of a scary noise. I always pictured something like that kid from The Grudge, you know, that weird, like, throaty noise. He's like, you're making these weird noises in your sleep. You don't know if it's good or bad. And so right from the beginning, it was like ambiguous, like what kind of noises she's making. There's a scene in the graveyard when she's like, has this dream, and then she's choking on like, and she's dreaming that she's being covered in dirt and then she's choking. So a lot of it is like, you know, having trouble breathing when you're asleep, you know, having just weird noises, like upsetting noises. Yeah, I think there was right from the get-go, there's this parallel with like, or dissonance, I guess, with the noises in the book.
So one of the parts I always forget about in the comics making space is the inherent mathiness of it, of like, it has to be this number of pages, and we've got to do like half, we're going to split it half-half. And, you know, some people like to invite even more math of like, there can't be more than this many words in a bubble and blah, 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 blah. Like, is there like a parallel universe where like you and Lisa could make this story and do exactly the number of pages that you want and exactly the number of everything that you want, like kind of formlessly? Or do you feel like the mathiness of comics helps you finish the story?
I like the structure of a comic, and I think structure does inform plot. So, you know, when we did this book, it was very much like, figure out what's the form that this book is going to take and how is the story going to fit into it. So I think if I was left to my own devices personally, I would be like a little lost, because I'd be like, but how many pages? Like, that's gonna tell me what we need to do. I think there were parts where it's like, you have to worry about pagination and page spreads and keeping the page counts equal for both. So there is a little bit of juggling.
Yeah, I mean, it was just made really easy for me by Becky, because we work together really well and we know one another so well. And we've been talking about this for, I'm sure Becky's mentioned it, for 10 years already. We kind of like had it all set in motion. And so it felt very intuitive as soon as we figured out that Becky was going to be doing the real world stuff and I was going to be doing the dream stuff. It kind of just all came together very easily. And, you know, also seeing Becky's inks and the emotion she brings into the characters in that, you can just ride off that. She's like such an amazing illustrator. And the expressions that she gets in her eyes, I feel like it was the easiest job in the world.
Well, we're hitting our time here. So let's wrap things up. We could talk
forever
about Somna. We had such a good time with this series. We found it extremely challenging
and provocative.
So thank you so much to both of you.
Oh, I'm so glad you liked it.
The book is out now from Distillery. Please go out and snatch it up. Magazine format. We didn't even talk about the format. So beautiful.
Yeah. We love that size. Getting into your art with that size is just so good.
And we can't wait for the next collaboration. Thank you, too.
For anyone that missed any of the issues, the trade comes out on June 24th. So we're going to have some really, we're working on like the juicy details of that right now. So, yeah.
Take care, you two.
Thank you, you two. Bye.
Thank you.
And there you have it, our conversation with Becky Cloonan and Tula Lotay talking about Somna. Again, all three issues are out right now, but also be on the lookout for that hardcover.
I want to pick up with something you put down before the interview proper. This idea of the demon being real complicates the situation, because if the demon is real, that actually makes Father Goodman and Roland right.
I mean, it validates their paranoia.
And to me, like, especially after having this conversation with Becky and Lisa, like, the demon being real is almost like a moot point, because the hell that it's created in the waking world for Ingrid and for other women is way worse than anything that demon is doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think Becky and Tula answer that stress that I put out there in this conversation by saying that, you know, by interpreting the final panel the way that Tula does. And I do think it's interesting that Becky had a different idea of what the ending of this book was until she saw the art of that final panel from Tula. And for Tula, the demon offers relief to Ingrid, rescue from the culture that she is trapped in.
I love the idea of two creators creating one story of which they both have different interpretations of. I love the idea of just like slipping a perspective in there, kind of like Lisa was very like open to talking about that blue panel. But, like, she did the blue panel without going to Becky and going, like, is it okay if I interpret it this way or that way? Like, it's like, I'm just going to do this.
Yeah, and the impression that I got was that Becky was initially unsure of it, but then was won through the execution. Like, Lisa won her over.
That's what I love about stories and about talking about stories with their creators. One story is actually so many stories. It's Becky's headcanon, it's Lisa's headcanon, and it's my headcanon and Brad's headcanon, and everybody who reads the story reads something a little bit differently. Like, I loved the question I asked about the noises, because yeah. I was presuming, oh, they were orgasmic noises all of the way through, and that created this, like, super rich and meaningful through line.
And
for
they
me.
Were like, no, not no, necessarily. No, that's not what it was about. But at the same time, just because they say no, not necessarily, that does not mean that's not the case for you.
And it's going to, when I revisit this story, on my belly, open wide to me. When I revisit this story, I'm not going to let go of that thread just because I know that it wasn't the initial intention.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Although for me, I will, when I reread this story, think about it differently because of their interpretation of the final panel.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I don't know, for whatever reason, I did not necessarily get that when I closed the third issue the first time. But then when I looked at it immediately following this conversation, I went like, oh, no, yeah, that's clearly there. And that might actually revert the story back to the way that we culturally normally read and consume Witchfinder stories, where the village is always, you know, the evil thing, you know, human fear, human paranoia. That's the enemy. And it is certainly the enemy in Somna. And now, is Somna less subversive as a result of that interpretation of that final panel?
Somna stratifies it for me. Because when I went into this story, I was thinking about the way I gained my understanding of what the witch trials were really about. Because it gets introduced to you way, way younger than you can actually understand the nuances actually about.
Like, I was reading The Crucible, I think, in sixth grade, and that's nuts.
Yeah, that's crazy. And it is sold to you as, oh, this is a story about the danger of groupthink. And then as you get older, you understand, oh, it's a way to oppress women. And then as you get even older than that, you go, oh, it's actually to oppress women from expressing their sexuality, their creativity. You know, it is about controlling women's bodies. And, like, I feel like Somna creates a story in which all of those things are true. Paranoia is running rampant, but there are people like Father Goodman who are weaponizing that for specific, very on-this-earth reasons. And there are people like Roland who just think that they're being obedient and faithful. But when they start having their doubts, they fear for their own life and their own place in society. And there are people like Maya who are using the confusion created by the system of oppression to hide the evil things that they are doing.
Yeah.
And there are forces at work that we don't understand. There are ineffable things that make us do stuff we don't understand and can't articulate.
The subversion then in Somna is that the demon is relief. Like, yeah. The demon is the thing that you want to be with rather than the human world in which you're trapped in.
Yes, that's it.
It's exciting when you get a comic like this where you can read it once and come away with it thinking about it in a certain way. And then you can, you know, investigate it and challenge it and be lucky enough to have a conversation with its creators and then come away going like, oh, maybe it's something else. Let's give it another look. Like, it is a comic that's going to demand revisitation.
And it's also like a sexy book.
Yeah, and it's super sexy.
Right? So like we have the habit, I particularly have the habit of getting too cerebral and making books not fun.
Yeah.
This book is definitely fun.
Yeah, it's super fun. It's super fun. Just like the way that Witchfinder General is really fun and The Entity is really fun.
It's pulpy. Yeah. It's fun. It's
and it's gorgeous.
It's got boobs.
And like the way that Tula's art, Lisa's art, and Becky's art intersect and, you know, trade places at times. It's just exciting to read.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have too many experiences like this in comics. And again, treasury format. Magazine sized. I love it so much.
We're going to get the trade.
Oh, for sure. For sure. For sure. But I also feel like it's a comic that I'm going to enjoy reading in singles as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Okay. Because you're going to want to spread them out.
Yeah.
as you are listening to this episode, I am on a plane heading to Anaheim. I land in LA this afternoon and I prepare for WonderCon. Sadly, Lisa must remain here on the East Coast making that money so I can immediately put it into dollar boxes.
Ooh, thank you for taking one for the team, Brad.
You are welcome. And if you listening are at WonderCon this weekend, hit us up on our socials at CBCC Podcast. Find us on, you know, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, wherever. Message me. I will be reading them. And maybe we can connect and say hello to each other. You know, what's your boggle?
Well, he'll give you stickers and stuff and pins.
Yeah, stickers and pins and new buttons. We've got our new Our Psychic Rapport, our newsletter pin, hot off the press. And I'm ready to give it to you.
On our next episode, it will be another Creator Corner conversation. This one is key listening for people who want to start making their comics. It's with Zach Quaintance talking about the death of Comics Bookcase.
I loved this conversation. We had it the day after talking to Becky and Lisa about Somna. And, you know, we love Zach. We've known Zach for a while now. And Lisa used to write regularly for Comics Bookcase when it was like the blogging comics site. And we were pretty darn sad to see it go away or to evolve away from being that site. And now, like, Zach is making comics.
Yeah, so
but
cool.
Also speaking to the experience of shutting down Comics Bookcase. And he's killing it here in this Kickstarter campaign, this new graphic novel. Lisa and I had a chance to read that as well, and we had such a good time with it.
It is super inspiring. Like, I'm just ready to go out and make some comics. All I need is a good idea.
Yeah, same. And then we also have a conversation coming up with Jesse Lonergan and Pornsack Pinachot talking about their new Boom Studios series, Man's Best. We've had that conversation already, and it was freaking great. We also have a conversation with Daniel Warren Johnson talking about the first arc of his Transformers run. Always fun to talk to Dan. And we have our Schema episode that is still in progress, friends.
Still a simmering. It will be a great stew of an episode.
Yeah. But with all this X-Men 97 love, I really want to get back to Scott and Emma as soon as we can. And we're going to do that once I get back from WonderCon.
Other plugs, our Comic Book Film Club screening of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, Secret of the Ooze, is on April 21st at 4 o'clock at the Alamo Drafthouse Winchester.
Yeah.
Tickets are on sale now. If you're a patron, reach out to Brad and or Lisa. We'll get your ticket. C2E2, our next CBCC panel will be on Friday at 3:45. You'll be able to find the room number. We forgot it off the dome. We don't have it.
We'll talk more about the details in the future.
Sign up for our newsletter. It is free. It's called Our Psychic Rapport. And then, on Patreon, we'll be finishing up Sandman Endless Nights. And there's also a car ride review of Hellboy.
Yeah,
if that's your thing.
I loved that conversation that we had in the car driving home from Winchester talking about that 2004 comic book adaptation. I freaking love Guillermo del Toro.
Me too.
I love Hellboy and I love Mike Mignola. And that's just such a weird collaboration.
Yeah.
But the more I think about it, the more successful it is and the more shocking and surprising that it ever happened is. So yeah, Patreon. The links to all those things are in the show notes. Hit them up and browse around that Patreon. See if there's some other cool things you might be interested in too. It's just $1 a month or $12 a year.
Yeah. Okay, Brad.
Yes.
I'm feeling a little snoozy. I
Uh-oh.
Have a date with a demon.
Uh-oh.
Where can our listeners send their words of affirmation to you?
You can find me on most social medias at MouthDork. If you have words of affirmation for our logo, you can send them to Aaron Prescott at A Cool Hand Fluke. And if you have some words of affirmation for our radical banner art and show posters, send them to Karen Chapp at Karen_X-Men Fan. Lisa, where can our listeners send their words of affirmation to you?
I'm always accepting words of affirmation at Sidewalk Siren on Instagram and Twitter. If you'd like to spend more quality time with us, you can subscribe to us on Podbean, Spotify, YouTube, Audible, Apple Podcasts, or whatever app you prefer. We're everywhere. If you'd like to get exclusive, you can join our Patreon, where you'll get more content, including weekly bonus episodes.
If you'd like to reach out and touch us electronically, you can email the podcast, cbccpodcast@gmail.com. You can visit our website, comicbookcouplescounseling.com, or follow us on all the socials at cbccpodcast.
You can give us the gift of 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, and if you'd like to do an act of service, why not write a review of the show while you're there?
Yes, please.
We are fluent and receptive in all 5 love languages. It really warms our hearts and helps the pod.
So until next time, friends, keep your love tank full
and your psychic rapport open. Doopie doopie. Bum, bum, ba-da, bum, bum, ba-da, ba. You are now in session with the Comic Book Couples Counseling Podcast. Now you're giving me the yips.
Well, I'm giving you the yips?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Okay.
How do I give? I don't even really understand the yips. It's a baseball thing.
Yeah, you've made me afraid to say the name of our podcast.
Oh, with my looks?
Yeah, you look like this.
That is how I look.